Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. Today, I have the double delight of speaking with a certain dynamic duo, Avishwed Luri, who is in the philosophy department at Hunter College, and his student and very close collaborator, the independent scholar and Berlin-based writer and philosopher, Joydeep Bagchi. Welcome to the program, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Raj.
So as you can see from the link you just clicked on, we're talking today about a very important book on the Mahabharata. There's much about this book that will be, let's say, nerdy or will make sense to folks like us who study Sanskrit narratives or the Mahabharata or the Puranas. But nevertheless, this book, I feel, is so very important for Hindu studies at large, certainly indispensable reading for Mahabharata scholarship. And I think it has reverberations which are important in our time, in our culture, in terms of understanding the history of ideas. So maybe first tell us about how you got into this project. Someone say something about the genesis, or how did this project come about?
The genesis really is from our own need, or our perception that there was a need for a work like this, that, you know, simply to help people use the edition, understand what the critical edition is, what the volumes are, how it's all been laid out, you know, how do you go to the critical apparatus, how do you check the manuscripts available. There was nothing like that for Mahabharata studies. It had never been done, although it's the largest critical edition project that has ever been undertaken. And it's just voluminous. I mean, it's 19 volumes plus the Khila, the Harivamsa, and then the entire Pratika index. And so we found that in scholarship, there was a lot of sort of confusion about what the edition is. And we thought, hey, what a great idea if we could write a guidebook and, you know, simply step by step, take people through the edition from its principles, from the logic behind textual criticism, all the way down to the appendices of this book, which is all about the different editions available, the translations available. And that's why it's really important. The title is Philology and Criticism, but then right before that, it just says a guide. And that's what we wanted, a guidebook.
Okay, so essentially, this is a sophisticated, erudite, Cole's Notes, or Reader's Digest, of how to approach a text. And this touches upon one of the elements of these interviews, which is a methodology. So this is a textual project where you're looking at the text, but even before making sense of the text, this is that vital phase that is largely overlooked when we're looking at the Mahabharata, which is putting together the text. Like, what is the text? What is the text of the Mahabharata? And so for audience members who may well be very confused right now about a critical edition or confusion about the text of the Mahabharata, you know, what is a critical edition? What is the Mahabharata? What is this mess that your book is trying to sort out? What do you have on your desk or in front of your eyes that you're trying to make sense of?
Okay. So the Mahabharata really is, as Sukhankar has said, it's the whole of the critical edition also, but let's get to that in a minute. The Mahabharata is the whole of the Mahabharata tradition, right? I think they found something like, in their survey, they found about 1,200 manuscripts from all parts of India. And each of them is slightly different. They have different narratives. but there's a kind of architecture holding them together. And they're sort of recognizably one work, albeit it exists in this kind of plurality of versions. So the Mahabharata is this great pan-Indic literary philosophical aesthetic project. And we should not restrict the Mahabharata simply to manuscripts that call themselves the Mahabharata, because as we know, the 18 Mahapuranas really take off where the Mahabharata leaves off. The whole stage setting with the narration to King Parikshit is coming out of the Mahabharata in a narrative that is told there, that Parikshit is bitten by a snake and he's going to die. And, you know, Bhagavatam famously sets itself there as, what should you do when you're going to die? I think it's in a week he's going to die, and so he hears these tales. So there's this kind of enormous explosion of thought in time and space that is radiating out across a good, I don't know, in land mass terms, maybe 7% or 10% of the globe. I don't know the statistics. But it's spread out like that. And if you are coming from a regional tradition, of course, that spread isn't a problem, right? You're reading whatever version of the text is available locally. Just as you have Kula Puranas, you have the local recension of the Mahabharata, and that's the one you grew up with, or you know, you heard, or you saw perform. But how do you come at it if we are slightly, you know, one step out of the tradition with the kind of distance that modernity inevitably imposes on us? And then you suddenly see all these versions and they begin not to make sense. And there's a lot of confusion about what the text is. And, you know, some will say this is not in the text. And there were these debates going on that people from South India were complaining and saying that, you know, the Calcutta edition, for example, which is based on Devanagari manuscripts mainly, it doesn't have these stories, et cetera, et cetera. And there is no way to sort of reconcile this distinction between the two. But one way it can be done is to follow a strict hierarchical principle, which is followed in textual criticism, that you establish the line of descent of manuscripts. You establish relationships of filiation between them and say that, you know, these manuscripts are later, these ones are slightly older, these ones are linked through a remote ancestor. And going back like that, you infer what the reading of their common ancestor would have been. And then you take all that information, you don't throw away anything. You create really the superset of Mahabharata manuscripts where you print the common archetypal text, which would have been their ancestral text, you print it above the line, and then you subjugate or submit variants and you place them below the line. But in that way, you create a text that is the text of texts. And Sukankar is very, very adamant on this. He said, not even one line that has been found in any major recension or in any manuscript will be omitted from this edition. And that's an unusual principle. I mean, that's not always been adhered to. Certainly, you can take the best manuscript and just edit that and leave everything else out. That he went down this line speaks something. I mean, it really says something for the pan-Indic nature of the critical edition. So I'll stop there. I'll let Vish say something he wants, and you know.
Yeah, this is a point which is the other side of what Joy has been saying. It's a pan-Indic text. It has many variations. And scholars have often felt that there was no such a thing as an archetypal text. Mahabharata was a text in free fall that so many versions can only be dissected according to time, and we should look for layers, and that there was an original warrior text, Kshatriya Ur Epos, if you will, and that this was the main kernel of the Mahabharata, and everything else has been added to it. Not so. The critical edition demonstrates that the Mahabharata, for all its versions, is also a text of extraordinary integrity, structure that has been preserved throughout its history by very faithful scribes who copied manuscripts quite faithfully. So The critical edition that Sukthankar creates allows us to have a glimpse of what this archetypal text would look like. And lo and behold, we find that 75,000 verses are part of this archetype. This provides us with the way of looking at Mahabharata in the future, mainly because we always thought that the so-called philosophical, theological, ethical portions were added later on. Not so. Now we know that whatever the date of the Mahabharata is, this archetypical text contained a full theology, Nivritti Dharma, Pravritti Dharma, Avatara theory, the notion of Dharma and dialogues on Dharma. All these are now part of Mahabharata. So the work was, when we started it, we had an open mind. We just thought, what could the critical edition do? But what the critical edition has unearthed is that the histories of the text we have in scholarship today need to be revised. And so we now have not the Mahabharata or a Mahabharata, but we have, I think, the parameters beyond which we cannot go. And we have a blueprint for all future Mahabharata studies. They should be based on the.
So the work is, at its core, essentially, for our listeners, it's a defense of using the critical edition of Mahabharata. And the need for that defense, if it isn't obvious, is that there are various scholars who feel, who surmise, who conclude, whether rightly or fallaciously, that there is no inherent story essence to the Mahabharata, and then it's a slapdash, haphazard accretion over time, mm-hmm. Subject to various cultural expressions and sort of political and religious appropriations. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting to me to read this book because at some portions it's like a math textbook, right? It's mapping out very incisively theories about the lineage of the Mahabharata or in refuting various other theories. So to my mind, it clearly holds water, but that's neither here nor there. It's a fascinating book, whether you agree with it or not. You must read it if you're interested in the Mahabharata. What's interesting for me in my armchair thinking about the Mahabharata is that the very project of the Mahabharata seems to me to wrestle with religious ideologies. And so one cannot really conceive of the text mm-hmm. before this. For me, it's more exasperated with Puranas where, mm. you know, slicing and dicing for the sake of getting at the real Purana, whereas the parts that are on the cutting room floor, that is the Purana, right? Mm. And so there's so much we could talk about with this text. Mm.
I'd like to say something vis-a-vis what you just said, Raj. There are two points there. One point is you said whether scholars rightly or fallaciously believe that the text is a text in free fall. Well, and you also brought up the fact that it's like a math. That was the whole point. The whole point is to bring to bear logic, argumentation, manuscript evidence, in order to sort of evaluate all the various things we say about the text. And so I'm not too fond of this view that there is an expertise that sort of determines the nature of a text. It cannot be. This text is too far away from us. It is too complex for us to handle. It contains so many facets. One will have to be a philosopher, a grammarian, a literary theorist, an artist. In one's own right, in order to fully kind of grasp the text. So the math portion allows us to put to rest, I think, hopefully, and that's the whole point of the book, certain fallacious theories. So yes, we still can agree or disagree about things that have no argumentation possible, but for things for which manuscript evidence is present, there's no further room for disagreeing with how the Mahabharata presents itself. And it seems to me that the Mahabharata in the Adi Parvam gives a pretty good idea of what the text is and how it should be approached. So that was.
Thank you. Do either of you want to share one or two of the most common arguments against the critical edition that you debunk in the book?
Yeah, I could jump in there. Let me first go back to something you said in the previous thing that you said that, you know, a lot of scholars feel that there's just no one story in this text. You said something like there's not one identifiable narrative. Actually, I think the problem has always been the reverse. Scholars have been too quick to identify one story in the text. And it's always been that Kuru conflict, the dynastic conflict. And if you read someone like Van Burtnen, who's otherwise a very good scholar, and, you know, his Bhagavad Gita introduction, some of his other articles, he has some profound things to say. But in his Mahabharata introduction, he very hastily makes that move and says that this is clearly the core story. And then he has this, you know, perimeter upon perimeter is added to it. And that's been really the prejudice the Mahabharata has been fighting against, that if you come at it with this sense that it is a monologue, you know, that there is a kind of universality to the text, it becomes difficult because it is better to look at it as some kind of braid where identifiable threads are running through it. You know, obviously, Bailey has identified the Pravritti Nivritti threads.
Raj also has written on it.
Yeah. So it's better to tease out a single thread and always be aware that there's more to read and more we can complexify. So let's come to what your second question, which you just asked. Prejudices against the critical edition or reasons not for not using it. Let's take someone, a thinker, a writer that Vish and I really cherish, and that's Madeline Biardo. And she was quite critical of the critical edition project. She thought it was unnecessarily historicist. She thought that we should be reading the Vulgate. Her edition was the Chitrashala Press edition, which is largely Nilakantha's Vulgate edition. Obviously, she was aided there by the fact that there is a commentary on that edition. But, you know, some of her criticisms we can engage with now intelligently and say that, contrary to her fears, that this would be a project that set aside the reception of the text, that privileged some kind of reconstructed text over the extant manuscripts and the material attestation for the text that we have in the manuscripts, and privileged one text to the expense of regional traditions. The wonderful thing about the way Suttanka set up the CE project was that he kept all these variations, he kept all the variants, kept these enormous, gigantic passages, Appendix 1, which is simply passages that are too long for a conventional critical apparatus. So that is why when we begin the book, Philology and Criticism, we take a different lens on the critical edition. It's no longer a question of merely a reconstructed archetype. It is now a question of how do you take all this textual richness and lay it out for the reader in a way that all the manuscripts are open to view at once. All the connections between them are apparent and all the textual variation is preserved. So, you know, the anxiety that Biardo had that this is privileging historicism has not actually panned out. And I think if she saw the edition today, if she had a chance to read Philology and Criticism, I think she would suddenly appreciate the edition much more.
Well, with any luck, she has been reborn as a scholar of the Mahabharata somewhere on the earth, and she'll read it again. Is there another main, there's a few in the book, but is there another main argument against the critical edition that you debunked that in the book that you'd like to talk about now?
Yeah, one of the sort of, I have a lovely quote here. Let me start with the quote from Michele Barbi, who is an Italian textual critic, and he writes, "It is not a matter of treating as certain what is only probable or forcing everyone to accept our conclusions. But when one has illustrated to scholars the state of things and the reasons for and against a given conclusion, has one not done what science allows and demands? Why should we give up considering each case for itself? And why should we not be allowed to substitute our cautious and reasoned judgment for that of a transcriber whose judgment we do not see the reasons for and cannot measure the extent of?" I think that quote, in a sense, he is speaking in general about the critical edition as a defense of, you know, these scientific editions where we are presenting our reasons and those reasons are transparently laid out so that scholars can then go over them. But that applies really to this edition in particular and to the use of this edition. Sukthankar has sort of documented his reasons, his thought process, and he's sort of left it up to us to consider the arguments. And once you've given the reason for and against, the only possibility now is a kind of reasoned engagement with it. So a lot of people set aside the critical edition as, you know, it's just a set of readings, just a set of variations. But it's not. It's more than that. It's definitely making certain claims about the relationship of manuscripts, and the editor has presented reasons for that. So we have to then engage at the level of arguments and say, for these reasons, I don't agree, or I accept the reasoning.
I would like to add something to that. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, good. There is also the, when the edition came out, I think Wendy Doniger wrote a piece as a review piece where she said, compared the critical edition to Frankenstein's monster, and that the Pune scholar Sanskritus had somehow pieced this together, taking scraps from here, scraps from there, and so on. And then she also insisted on the popularity of the Ganesha story, and she said that the critical edition moves that to, does not include that in the above the line reconstitution. Although, of course, Sukthankar preserves that Ganesha story and talks about it and says how important it is. So these kinds of, I would say, quick judgments are not warranted. The critical edition does not, for example, piece something from here and from there. And as Joy explained very clearly, for every single line, even for every single word, Sukthankar has looked at all the manuscripts and very mathematically and logically reconstructed it. So the math is essential, the logic is essential, the evidence is essential. We cannot begin with perceptions and how we wish the text was and then evaluate the method. The method has to be evaluated on its own, and whatever the method gives us about the text, we have to accept it. So another prejudice against the critical edition is that it is somehow like Frankenstein's monster constructed from scraps. And I think nothing could be further from the truth.
So we'll dig in a bit in terms of what you feel is the reasoning behind the various scholarly ideological bents or prejudices or what have you, given that this work is a continuation of a larger project. But first, let me ask you a question. The vast majority of folks who engage the Mahabharata, probably even scholars, understand it as once upon a time an oral, not written text. Tell us about that.
Oh, okay, great. That's a good question. That's sort of not in this book, or not, I mean, it's sort of at the background of the current book, but it's, you know, more a historical curiosity that had to be addressed before we could even come to this book. Obviously, it's a historical curiosity that, like a stone thrown into a pond, you know, had massive ripples and built up a certain kind of momentum and built up a kind of self-evidence that no one thought to go back and say, you know, why are we all saying this? You got it from me and I got it from you and we both got it from Hopkins. That kind of, you know, clearly it's in the air and we're all saying this, but let's step by step see where this is coming from. And that was the project actually of the predecessor volume, the Naissance, to say, all right, so Mahabharata studies for the last 200 years, it's been articulated by a set of very, very firm sort of canonical principles, doctrines, you know, statements of orthodoxy almost, if you like. And these orthodox things have to now be questioned, and not even questioned in the sense that we want to reject them. We just want to say, when did this orthodoxy come up? And it's a very recent orthodoxy. It's something that you could trace back. All of these principles come out again. I'm going to use the word big bang. There's a big bang of ideas in a single paper that is published in 1837. Where all these ideas are one by one sort of laid out. And because there is a vision of the epic at work there, they all somehow cohere together. But, and so because they all somehow cohere, scholars immediately took them up and thought, okay, this makes sense. But you have to understand that there is a fictional quality to this coherence because they're all part of the same narrative, they cohere. But if you, the reverse side of that is if you start questioning one of them, or you start becoming skeptical about one of them, all of them will fall. So the presumption that it's this oral epic is based on a further presumption that there were these bards that accompanied kings and told, you know, narrated or recited their heroic deeds in battle. And that rested on a further presumption that this text was all about a historical set of kings and bards. And that rested on a further presumption that, therefore, the Mahabharata war that is narrated is actually a historical event that's been blown up out of proportion. And that again rests on a further principle that there are these two sides fighting. And who, now that you've said it's a historical war, you've said it's an Indian prehistory, well, whom do you, which war do you identify it with and which groups do you identify it with? And then it was decided this is clearly the war where Aryans are invading into India, and it's that primordial racial conflict that's, you know, at the core. And then links were made, right? So Pandu is white, so he's probably Aryan. Krishna is black, so he's probably, you know, one of the natives, the aboriginal people. By the way, before I get too far ahead, this was done with devastating effect for the Ramayana also, where it was said that the monkeys are clearly the aboriginal population of India, the Vanaras, and their physical features, their noses and their skulls were so repulsive to the Aryans that the only way the Aryans could like integrate them into their story was to say these are half monkey, half human people. So you see how much of our prejudice, our way of looking at aboriginal peoples, our sort of aesthetic judgments were playing into this. And perhaps in the 19th century, we couldn't get skeptical when someone made that kind of judgment. Clearly, in the 21st century, when we hear those kinds of racial prejudices or those kinds of aesthetic prejudices, we should be a little more sensitized, or we should be a little more self-critical. So that's really where we started and said, once you start, as I said, all these things are daisy chain. Once you take even one element out of that, the story that's been told is not holding. And so we went back and sort of looked at the whole narrative and found that it was coming quite as an invented thing, as a created thing.
Yeah, you should mention the article that you were talking about.
It's 1837, Christian Lassen, Contributions to Indian Antiquity Based on the Mahabharata.
Okay, so you've raised some fascinating points about the prejudices of the past that appear to be well in vogue, whether consciously or unconsciously. That I encountered that as well in terms of understanding the Markandeya Purana, certainly the Devi Mahatmya.
Mm-hmm.
For example, it was thought for 150 years that it was an interpolation that never belonged there, and upon careful examination, it was crafted to fit like a glove into the Markandeya Purana. There's so many directions. One thing I want to say is, I have the luxury of leaping over this very rocky terrain that you're painstakingly working on. And
that was the whole point of writing this book,
right?
So that those who are truly interested in the text and have something genuinely philosophical or ethical or creative to say about the text, then they could do so easily. So I'm very happy to hear you say that.
No, I mean, I just naturally take a literary read. You know, one of my first loves was English in my undergrad, and I naturally look at the Puranas and the Mahabharata and the Ramayana as literature, and the results have been arguably insightful.
Mm.
And for me, that's just because it's obvious to me that the text is literature. It's obvious to me that there's powerful imaginative forces or even spiritual inspiration in terms of the Ramayana and the Vanaras, and there's profound insights there. Mm-hmm. Without talking about a story of colonized Buddhist tribal folks who look like monkeys to the noble ancestors. And so there's a lot there. So maybe this is a good time to tie what you're doing with this Defense of the Critical edition to its predecessor, the Nay Science, and explain to our audience why it's so important. I mean, it's very important to establish the logic that allows the project to cohere. Obviously, that's crucial for anybody studying the Mahabharata using the critical edition, whether in its original or even in translation. Now, there is a bigger project of the reasonings behind the prejudices to begin with, and maybe you could talk a bit about that larger project of your work.
So, Vish, can I jump ahead? So the larger project is actually even larger than the Nay Science you introduced the previous book, but the Nay Science itself is sort of just a very small element in a larger project that Nietzsche actually framed, which he did in a series of lectures. He called them Wir Philologen, We Philologists. He also talked in Schopenhauer as educator, and then he wrote this book, Lectures on Anti-Education, is the published volume on the future of
our educational institutions.
And one of the things he was deeply concerned with is that texts such as the Homeric Epics, right? Plato already says that Homer is the educator of Greece, and Homer and Hesiod give the Greeks their gods. So, and Plato, with all his criticisms of Homer, of imitative poetry, constantly says, I'm reluctant to criticize him because of the great respect I have. So we are moving, Nietzsche says, we're moving from a tradition where these enduring classical models, which sort of raised not just the Greeks, but sort of raised Europe in a sense for so many centuries and provided enduring paradigms that even in someone like Schiller feels it necessary to go back, and you have the opera tradition that they go back to these stories and pick up on Greek tragedy, pick up on these. We are losing that. And why are we losing it? Because a culture of specialization has crept in, that antiquity is no longer thought to provide enduring models for the present, neither in terms of their artistic works nor in terms of the people they present, but a different kind of normative understanding has taken over. This is the modern critical self-consciousness, which is now turning on the past. This happens famously at the French court in the quarrel between the ancients and moderns. And then that kind of has knock-on effects where we now engage with these texts from such a specialized perspective and with such a critical thing that we have failed to provide models for ourselves. And the Nietzschean project that education is in some kind of crisis, because although we have lived through the past century of sort of burgeoning specialization, micro-specialization, you know, universities have grown as very large institutions, but their general relevance to culture has declined. If you think about it, where do we take our inspiration, our cultural guidance, our cultural lead from? It's the media, it's journalism, it's Hollywood, and the university has sort of become a 19th century remnant. It is no longer leading that conversation. And Nietzsche is very aware of this. It's easy for us to see now, but he's being quite prophetic when he says this in the 19th century. So the project that the Renaissance is tapping into is not as limited or simple as saying, you know, what is the Mahabharata? Where is it coming from? Why aren't we reading it aright? It's coming from that Nietzschean question that if you get rid of these educating, these pedagogic works that tell you, for example, the Homeric epic will tell you what it means to be a hero, so also Mahabharata will show you what Arjuna, the hero, is like. It will contrast that with the egotism and the materialism of the Kauravas. So it's sort of giving you, you know, and obviously I need to add nothing about Rama as a model for Dharma. What happens when we take that out of our culture? And isn't that a sort of serious loss that cannot be compensated by one or two clever etymological things that we've discovered? So that would be, you know, the big thing into which the two books are fitting.
And also, we are right. There are so many social justice issues that we need to address. And Joy and I are outsiders in the sense of being diaspora. And even within the diaspora, to have, you know, a minority sexual identity and so sexual orientation and so on. So there are social issues for which we have suffered and paid for, but I disagree that that social justice alone is the purpose for which all these texts exist. You should have political solutions. You should have reasoned representation, arguments, and so on, and affect social change differently. But conversion of the aims of education and making it the handmaiden of social justice fighting has neither helped social justice. I mean, for all the anti-Semitic and anti-Brahmanic rhetoric that these scholars have produced, they have not either prevented bad things from happening, nor have they been able to enable good things from happening. So why throw away, 2,000 years of study for feel-good righteousness and breast-beating righteousness, which we can do without these texts, you know? And so we looked at these prejudices. They go back to, originally, they were not just about social justice or just about, you know, being clever about and providing a political commentary using Ramayana as a springboard. They were part of a systematic evangelical theological vision. Now, I do not criticize Christianity. In fact, the evangelical portion of Christianity, the theological portion of Christianity, still grappled with the big questions. So I respect them for that. What happens when that those elements fall out of our scholarship and no longer guide our scholarship, but we continue doing that kind of scholarship now by substituting it for simply, you know, this is a social justice issue. This makes, as to tie it into what Joy was saying, this is our big project. Our big project is to somehow protect the value of great works of art and great texts for culture and to repair or provide at least a diagnosis of what has gone so wrong with the humanities and why they have. I mean, there was an article in Chronicle of Higher Education which called academia to be at the point of extinction. Is that the title?
Yeah, it's called Academia's Extinction Event.
Yeah, Academia's Extinction Event. And I think we need to, I have all the respect for all the senior scholars in humanities and so on, but I think it's time for at least the younger generation to quickly sort of do something different because what was being done isn't working.
There's so much fascinating about what you're saying, far-reaching and fascinating. We probably could pursue a great many threads in what you've said. I will say personally that I'm in this interesting space of teaching continuing studies primarily and teaching privately. I'm virtually an independent scholar insofar as I fund my own research and conferencing and whatnot, but I have an instructorship at the University of Toronto School of Continuing Studies. So I'm in a very interesting space as academic all to ACC all at the same time. And one of the things that's so fascinating is that I can do with continuing studies and with private students and with coaches, I can do with these texts what I can't do in an academic setting, which is ironic. I can't teach phrases. Right? In the sense that there's so much humanistic value in these texts. And it raises the question of whether or not it's you know, perhaps world religions is the history of religion. Perhaps Hinduism is a history of Hinduism. Of course, clearly we're not talking about compromising rigor. But at the same time, for me, it's like the profound humanistic value of Indian narrative texts and spiritual texts. And not just Indian, from various traditions I draw from based on the clients and the students and where they're coming from, but the profound humanistic value ironically cannot be tapped where people come to learn about them at the academy.
This is Nietzsche's issue, that the university may have ceased to be a place of learning or openness, right, anymore. That these have become factories where we produce these dissertations, we appoint successors, and A recommends their students to B, and B recommends their students to A, and then we keep this going. But it cannot go on. We are already at the end of that that last game, which the generation of scholarship before us played. So. What you're saying is absolutely fascinating, because you can, even in Hollywood, they take up themes from Homer and in Bollywood, perhaps from epics and the Purana tradition, and they are able to speak to the public at large, whereas we university people have gone from being educators to becoming irrelevant to the public. To outright annoying them by just sort of talking down to them about what they hold sacred and valuable. And it's a very sad situation. And I completely agree with you that you would be more comfortable outside these days. Any thinking person is more comfortable outside the university than in the university, which is a very sad thing.
Sorry, go on, Joy.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that the situation you're in is actually sort of characteristic of an entire generation of academics. You know, let's say it starts around 2000, that many people find that the conventional university system is not working, it's not creating the jobs or giving them the jobs or not giving the talented people the jobs. And it's also not answering either their questions or basic human questions. And this kind of continuing education you're doing clearly shows that people still have questions. They do want to learn. They do want to read these texts. But not as we have done, which is that, you know, if you go to a regular class, all you'll hear is 19th century names and a kind of litany that will be repeated. So-and-so was great. So-and-so did this. So-and-so established this etymology. So-and-so said Mahabharata could be this. And they don't want to hear that. They want to read the primary text. And they want to read it with a naivety, a freshness, and also a kind of purposiveness to their lives. So if I may, I just want to take a few sort of a little, what's it called? You said a 30,000 view from 30,000.
There's an expression that came from a previous colleague, the 30,000 foot view. So the big picture.
Yeah. So we always debate from our technical sort of scholarly perspective, what is the Mahabharata, and you know, but let me give you a view from 30,000 of it, which will be immediately apparent to most people who know this text, and certainly to a lot of Indians. I'll just read out a couple of points. I won't give the citations for them, because these are some notes that we should get. The Mahabharata is a comprehensive text. It is joined to the four Vedas and to yoga. It is a Shastra. All goals of man, especially the three worldly ones, dharma, artha, kama, are reflected in it. It is also Itihasa and Purana. The Mahabharata is conceived of as the fifth Veda. Vyasa composes it after dividing the Veda. It is the support of the Veda. It is Karshna Veda. The sages weigh the Mahabharata against the four Vedas, and in every way the epic outweighs them. So that's as much on the text and its project, which is sort of crystal clear. Then on its philosophical project, the Mahabharata is an Upanishad which glorifies Lord Vasudeva, whom it equates with Brahman, as the Shashvatam Brahma Paramam Dhruva. Further, Adhyatma is taught here, and the text reflects the highest self. The Veda should be elucidated based on Itihasa and Purana. The Veda is afraid of a man of limited education, thinking he will destroy me. So, you know, again, a clear cut. There's not a lot of debate or doubt about these textual aspects, because the text itself is telling you these things. And let me just give you three or four more points. The distinction between the three goals and the four, between the Veda and the Upanishad, between the universe and Brahman, are reflected in the distinction between time and eternity. Krishna Dvaipayana and Krishna Vasudeva represent these two aspects, becoming and being. Becoming is the world and the text. Krishna Dvaipayana is the author and lord of both. Because he is the literary author and the literal father of the characters, the distinction between the world and the text collapses. Reality belongs to Brahman. Krishna Vasudeva is Brahman. The Mahabharata teaches two dharmas of pravritti and nivritti, signifying these two aspects of reality, the transactional and the transcendent. And then the last passage, the last point is a little long, so I won't read that. But basically what we have here is a normative dharma text. It's non-utopian. It's not trying to perfect the world, but it's trying to perfect the individual. And so it's urging us to seek sort of self-perfection, self-realization, and to transcend the world. I read this out. I know it's a little bit long. I read this out to show you that very clearly and comprehensively, there's a project to the text. There's a self-consciousness to the text. It's telling you what it's trying to do. It's telling you who the Adhikaran is, for example, right in the beginning. And it's telling you who should approach the text and how they should approach the text. So for 1,000 years, there was sort of no confusion and no doubt about this. An entire tradition of people, until and unless we want to call them all monkeys and aboriginals and, you know, pretend that they had no intelligence or kind of thing, they read it as a meaningful text. So we, in large part, have created these problems, pseudo problems, problems of dating, pseudo historical questions, you know, pseudo scientific questions about method and approach, ignoring the basic needs, the basic reasons that humans have texts, the basic reason that people go to continuing ed is, you know, let me invoke Kant to ask the three questions. What can I know? What may I hope? And wish, remind me the third.
What ought I do?
What ought I do?
So hearing you speak, it's fascinating to me, because it seems to me that, you know, teaching undergrads is quite rewarding in that you're afforded the chance to have whatever little impact you have in someone's journey, whether it's scholarly or personal or professional or what have you. And there's a need, you know, there's a need to establish critical thinking. There's a need for the litany of you know, 19th century European names. It's interesting to me, because you both have so
you know, your critical thinking obviously works fine. It's sound, and you're so absorbed. What most grapple with, right? Most come to the Mahabharata thinking it's a text transcribed by Ganesha, dictated by Vyas in one sitting. And see, both sides are needed. And it's, you've internalized the fact that this was somewhat of a moving target through space and time. Right, and that you need to think critically about it, and that's the piece where academic training is needed. And yet, at the same time, that can't eclipse the very purpose of the text. It may or may not be the place for the academy to derive transformative power from the text, but it's certainly not the place of the academy to eclipse that vision of the text. The text is made for the transformation of consciousness. Whether you mean that in an ultimate moksha yogic sense, whether you mean it in terms of learning a lesson, learning a life lesson about how to deal with an adversary, how to deal with a problem. I mean, it's fundamentally pedagogical about life learning. And yet we reduce it to what everybody has thought about it at the academy for the last 150 years. That's how we talk about the text. And both are needed. But you know, obviously, because you know you're not. The question then becomes, you know, how do we safeguard against skirting with the opposite dogmatic approach, where we take the text on as the gospel truth, so to speak? And that's one thought that comes to mind. Obviously, I don't think that's the issue in this conversation.
Let us take the Mahabharata as a God. I don't know what gospel truth means anyway. It seems like if it's the gospel, it's the truth, and if it's the truth, it's the gospel. But let's take the Mahabharata. It is a Stri Shudra Veda. It takes care of, it is amplifying the Vedic revelation to include everyone, women, deranted people from the margins. It has gone beyond gender. Take the story of Shikhandin, for example. Vyasa packs Upanishadic mantras into the Bhagavad Gita and elsewhere throughout the Mahabharata. So in a way, the Shruti-Smriti distinction subverts social dogmatism that goes with Shruti. In every way, Mahabharata gives an account of human desire and its problems. You know, people talk about Marxism today. They do not even realize that Marx does not give an account of an individual human's desire. So the orexis, the capacity for desiring thing, this wasn't Plato, this was in Aristotle. Plato talks about how there can be a doctor who's a good doctor who only works for the sake of his skill of taking care of his patients, and his money making is secondary to it. And so even in his occupation, that is a kind of self-regulation. So all these, Marx does not have a question of individual human desire. And today we talk about Amazon as if it is something foisted upon us from above, but we each one individually makes choices, and it's our desires that Amazon is tracking on an individual level. So Marxism can no longer function here. For the reasons I just said, we only have the Mahabharata. So given all these things, you see, 200 years ago in the university, they were calling them monkeys, people of other races. In the Mahabharata, even animals are included in dialogue. We're not talking about vanaras anymore. We're talking about like out and out birds and mongooses giving, you know, eloquent lectures on dharma. So what is, and then this whole notion of Bharavatarana, that the planet is in a kind of a crisis and it requires a kind of an unburdening. In other words, humans have become a burden on the planet. That's a very shocking revelation right there, which is sort of something we need to grapple with today in terms of climate change. So I think that it is not the very opposition of academic versus this sort of traditional dogmatic readings is actually coming from the Protestant critique of Catholicism. Because if you truly, truly read the texts, no Indian read the Ramayana to sort of throw their wives away. You know, this is something new. So if I look at what academics say, and I look at what the reactionary right wing says, there is an uncanny harmony between these two. These two seem to are fighting over what it is that we have to foist upon the text. Should we foist a narrative that deconstructs a narrative that you have foisted that ought to be deconstructed? I mean, it's bizarre. So I think my own experience has been to reject that kind of a dichotomy, and my own experience was to just read the text, and even reading small amounts of the text, one narrative thoughtfully, create so much transformation. I mean, there have been dark moments in my life where reading portions of these texts allowed me to, you know, in spite of everything, sit and keep working and keep working and keep working. I think, I'm getting carried away by my love for these great texts. I will stop here.
Okay, we love, so we're good.
Thank you.
So beyond this systematic erudite defense of the critical edition of the Mahabharata, which is the tip of the larger iceberg of, if I'm hearing you correctly, offering a corrective to the direction of the humanities currently, what's next? Where are you going from here? Either individually or collectively?
So one of the things that, to keep some continuity to to our project and to the conversation, one of the things that the Mahabharata is clearly setting up is this thing that Yardo calls the universe of Bhakti, right? And she is absolutely adamant that this is the earliest articulation of Bhakti, that Bhakti is not this kind of lower caste phenomenon. We have the same kind of thing that was done to the Mahabharata about the great tradition, which is the Aryan, the upper caste, and then the lesser traditions, which are always folk or lower caste or aboriginal. Same thing is done to Bhakti very often. And she comes and says, this won't explain Bhakti. Bhakti is coming up in the Mahabharata. And she's right. I mean, historically, this is the earliest text. It is also not something that is simply a religion of unbridled feeling, even if it has emotive aspects, even if it expresses itself in these aspects. She's saying that as a soteriological path, Bhakti is taking the structures of the Vedic revelation and inverting them or transforming them. And so she calls it that, she says Bhakti arose from a rereading of the Vedic revelation that gave rise to a mythical universe of great complexity. And we often forget that, right? So there's so much literature on Bhakti that's been done. And shockingly, if you open some of those books and you scan them, there may be like the word Mahabharata comes up twice. It's not there in the index. It's not even indexed. And a lot of claims are made about the lateness of Bhakti, or someone said once at the AR meeting maybe 2 years back I was there, or maybe it was Denver, someone said that the 7th century or 8th century text is the first place you have Bhakti. And that's just monstrously ignorant of the textual history of not just the Mahabharata, but a whole lot of other things that have preceded up to the 8th century. So the next project is really to look at the Mahabharata and see it as this foundation that is giving us not just a textual basis for bhakti, but also the way bhakti is an intellectual, has an intellectual dimension, is occurring in dialogue with Vedic revelation, is taking those structures, which are obviously, restricted, esoteric, Brahmanic, and is now looking at a way to simplify, narrate, bring those to a larger audience. And that's really going to be the next project. So Vishwa's actually translated a key portion of the Mahabharata called the Narayaniya. And that is really the place where this transformation from the yogic path, which is followed by Shuka, that he ascends to Brahman, and that's the moksha path, that is now transformed by sage Narada following him, also flying up, going to see Narayana. But unlike Shuka, who remains there and takes claims moksha as his, Narada brings back the story. And what the Mahabharata achieves when it brings back that narrative is, you no longer need to go to Shweta Dvipa to see Narayana. Why? Because he has come down through the story and through the icon. And so the whole logic of moksha of an ascent has been reversed. And there is now a descending logic of the deity himself coming down, or the icon itself coming down, instituting its ritual, instituting its own worship, because Narayana gives Narada instructions and says, the following rituals have to be performed. I myself set them up. And so that grand, humanistic gesture of the Mahabharata, that incredible gesture of love, that outpouring, saying that, all of you come along, all of you, this knowledge is now outflowing through the Mahabharata. It's no longer a secret Upanishadic wisdom. It's available to you, and bringing everyone in there, that gets occluded a lot. And so that's the next project. It's the publication of the Narayaniya, and hopefully Vish will finish his commentary in time, because it's expanding, but we want the commentary. And then from there, going into bhakti and looking at, Hinduism as this enormous continuing revelation, that the revelation has really not ended. It's not a question of Shruti and Smriti, but it's Smriti itself. Without Smriti creating the category of Shruti, establishing the four Vedas as canonical by saying, I'm the fifth in relation to those four, you don't even have the notion of Shruti.
Well, that obviously sounds fascinating. We will definitely have to have you back when that new book is out. Fish, do you want to say anything about your upcoming project? Or are there any points?
Joy and I are working on a reader for how this race comes up in academia, especially in terms of Indology, beginning with Schlegel and certain needs for, and Lassen, of course, and certain needs of theological needs for creating a race in a way that would, distinguished Semitic races, sort of mark them off from the Indo-European or the Indo-Aryan thing. So there are a lot of primary texts there that we are collecting and translating. So there is a book on race, critical race theory, in terms of its earliest theoretical manifestation. So that's also in the works for next year.
Sounds like you are both very busy, and hopefully so, fruitfully engaged.
How can you sleep? There's so much to do.
indeed. So is there anything else that you had hoped we touch on, or that you want to say about the work or anything before we taken enough of both of your time for today? We'll sign off shortly, but is there anything else you wanted to touch on?
Can I take I won't do all of it, but I just want to give the readers a little taste of the book, and let's end on that. Is that fine with everyone?
Sure. Let us have our first new books in Hinduism network, a teaser.
Okay. So the introduction is titled Ad Fontes, Non Ultra Fontes, and that is back to the sources, not beyond the sources. And I'll just read you the section summaries in that about this book. The aim of this book and its connection with our first book the central problem confronting Mahabharata studies. Then the next section, why a critical edition, why a critical text is required, and what problem it attempts to solve. And then three, what is a critical edition? A description of the critical edition, its components, how it reduces the plurality of readings to one, and what the status of the resultant text, the constituted text, is. Three misconceptions about the critical edition. This was the question you asked. And the three misconceptions are: one, it is eclectic; two, it is not a text; and three, it can be replaced by a text with an apparatus of variants. And the final section I'll read out is how to interpret the critical edition. The text reconstructed in the critical edition is the archetype of the tradition, defined as the latest common ancestor of the manuscripts examined for that edition. This sense of archetype should not be confused with the archetype as an especially authoritative or unique exemplar, for our stemma is merely hypothetical and models only a part of historical reality, the part that is either preserved in or can be reconstructed from our manuscripts. So I'll end there.
Thank you so much, Raj.
No, thank you, Joyce. So thank you both.
Okay.
For those of you listening, as you know, we've been speaking with Ishwar Lohri and also Joydeep Baichi about Philology and Criticism, a seminal book in Mahabharata studies, very significant for Hindu studies at large. So until next time, keep reading. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.